So welcome, everyone. Welcome. Nice to see you all. Nice to see you. As some of you may know, my wife has been away sitting at the Forest Refuge in Massachusetts for the whole month, and so I've been sort of being quiet. I couldn't say a retreat, but I've been pretty quiet, staying at home. And sometimes, for those of you who have come out of retreat, know that words don't come flushing back in the same way they used to when you were engaged, fully engaged. So bear with me tonight. I do feel, you know, that I need a little bit of jaw lubricant as this thing gets going. So tonight, I picked the topic. You might be somewhat surprised by it. It's called Staying Within Yourself, because this is one of the last classes I will formally teach. You might have expected a sort of one of those, you know, send you to outer space talks. But I thought, you know, I wanted it to be relevant to everyone, first of all. And although those cosmic talks sometimes encourage people forth and can arouse curiosity, still there's a fundamental principle that I think within almost everyone's spiritual journey they'll slip somewhere on. And I don't know if I've addressed it well enough in the 20 years I've been teaching at SEMS. So I thought I would make a special point of it tonight, staying within yourself. And may I say that, you know, once we have a clear direction of where our practice takes us, and that was all of last year's classes were on the continua of practice, sort of where we begin and where we go ultimately in our Dharma practice. But we have to have a clear idea, that's fundamental, we have to have a clear idea of how we're using the life forces, the energies of life, towards our spiritual advantage. And that's what I mean by direction. If we don't have that, we're afloat without any wind, without any direction, without a compass. And so that's fundamental. But there's another fundamental that rests on that direction. And that is, once we have a direction, how do we govern those energies? What do we do with those energies that come in? And of course, I know all of you have heard many, many profound talks that seem to address that issue, but I'd like to take a different slant on the problem tonight, because I do believe that most of us at some point on our journey, and perhaps it's already occurred, will slip on this issue, and that is staying within ourself. Now, you see, I mean, the problem is pretty understandable. It's just we feel an urge to get involved spiritually in the beginning, and we have a whole set of conditioning that tells us that if we don't know something, we need to go to the texts and the teachers to find out, because that's been the way that most of us have learned. We've gone to school, there's been someone up front who's given us the lessons. If we want to add more content and more knowledge to those lessons, we have textbooks to do that. And so our default position is to learn from others and to learn from textbooks or from the past, basically, from people who have already learned those subjects. And so when we come into Dharma practice, because it seems so in some ways so intimately true to us, because you start hearing it and you go, whoa, this really sounds true. Yet we don't know how to access a continuation of that truth. We don't know how to abide within that kind of understanding. And we feel like we sort of shift in and out of it for many of the early years, that we begin to lean our practice away from ourselves towards those who will teach us. Now, fair enough, because we all need guidance. But there is a deeply troubling quality that many of us nurture, not only in the beginning when it's kind of natural to be inquisitive and to rest your dharma upon what others might say, because that is often sustained beyond its usefulness. And we become dependent upon others for our dharma understanding. And again, within the intellectual pursuits that we all went to school to learn the knowledge of the world, there's a kind of dependency that we have, not on our own resources, and what I mean by that is our own ability to discover the truth, but we become dependent upon the literature or the person who happens to be teaching. And so dharma is asking something else from us, and we're not clear how to access what is being asked. We hear about realization, but what's realization? I mean, I know how to intellectually understand something. I know the knowledge that I need and how to gain it, where to look for it. And we have it at our fingertips now. In my youth, we had to buy encyclopedias, but we have them very accessible now. And so that's one problem. But the other one is we don't, in this culture in particular, we don't have a spirit of questioning. We have a spirit of conformity, a spirit of mutual acceptance, you might say, but we don't have, it's not a culture that has bred a sense of independence in us, which is the basis for where questions come from, to ask a question about something rather than just to assume it's true. So our culture hasn't really fed that maturity of stature into us. And so we're a little bit lost in how to manage this. And so we look for teachers that can tell us how to do these things. And what happens is that instead of really fostering the sense of curiosity about what it is that's occurring, we think of curiosity as sort of a problem that we need to solve by knowing the answer. Curiosity is not something that we nourish. It's something we want to get over and to have the answer so that we no longer are befuddled by the question. So, because that's the way we've always done it. We didn't get A's in school by being curious. We got A's in school by knowing the answer. And knowing the answer is the opposite of curiosity. So in this system, we're breeding curiosity. We're breeding, we're evoking, we're suggesting that there is something to being curious rather than astute, rather than knowledgeable, rather than sophisticated. And so that again is not something that we necessarily have any experience with. And so when we come into our spiritual journey, you know, we're quoting the Buddha all the time. and or our teachers. And the Buddha said this, the sutta say that, the teacher says this. And because that's the way we were as conditioned school children. But we don't, and that satisfies a certain intellectual appreciation of the subject, but it really doesn't orient us in the proper direction of what the Dharma really is. And so there are two forces that will distort your Dharma practice from the beginning. One is believing your thoughts. Two is believing other people's thoughts. Okay, so we all know, because we've talked endlessly about just believing whatever the conditioned ways that we have perceived the world. And this really is an amazing, when we really get a glimpse of how we're caught within the matrix of our own thinking, and that the philosophies and assumptions and expectations we have of life are really based upon certain ways that we have organized life to be perceived, and how we hold it together very tentatively. And when it breaks apart, like for some of us it did in the election, that's a falling apart of one's assumptions. We have to ask, what does the universe hold? Not what do I expect from the universe, but what is life really in its essence? Is it fair? Is it? Well, if it were, perhaps the election would have turned out differently. Is it decent? Again, you see, and what we're trying to do is not listen to the way our thoughts fabricate life or build it upon the assumptions that we would love to have it built upon, because when those assumptions don't manifest, then there's pain. And then the direction that we have taken our practice to be, say it was from suffering to not suffering, is going to fall apart moment after moment, because it's not built life is not built upon those assumptions. We have placed those assumptions upon life, and when life doesn't live up to the assumptions, that's a definition of suffering. And so we see then that we have to live in accordance to what life brings rather than what we bring to it. And therefore we can't trust our thinking, because our thinking is just what our expectations are, what we would like to have happen. Our conditioned tendencies towards pleasure and away from pain. So we can't trust those, we can't trust thoughts. But for some reason, many of us feel we can trust other people's thoughts. Now this is when it gets a little scary. Because are other people's thoughts more profound than yours? When they're also built upon the same assumptions that they have? I mean, really, we have 7 billion different realities colliding here. And that's just the human realm. I don't know about the animal realms. And so for us to say, okay, well, I don't know, but he or she does, is to then lay our worth, our hearts, upon someone else's conceptualization. Now, it's basic. This is basic Dharma teaching. Whenever our life is governed by concepts, we're at risk here. They're flimsy. They don't sustain themselves. And inevitably, they're going to create the tensions that take us back to the direction. Remember, I said that the first thing, the most fundamental component is knowing the directions that we're going on here. And if the directions we are conceded to our spiritual journey is the one laid out by the Buddha, then it's from suffering to not suffering. And so I have to keep looking at what I'm doing to myself on the spiritual path to sense whether I'm moving towards non-suffering or back towards a suffering continuum, the suffering endpoint. And one of the ways that we begin to understand how we suffer is that we substitute words for truth. And we live in accordance with the words we hear as the truth rather than experiencing the truth that's underneath the assumptions and the concepts that we have invested in. And so the derailment of the words and living the truth is really the movement from a worldly life to a spiritual one. And it takes a long time because, again, we just don't have the conditioning, the past, the momentum of how to do that. We're lost in that world. And so this is the reason that it seems to take as long as it takes. Now, I want to talk a little bit about dependency, because as I mentioned, much of our dependency has come from looking towards the teacher or the textbooks to tell us what is true about something. That's a dependency. And that dependency, we have to ask a few questions when we find a teacher that we resonate with and that we like to go listen to. What is it that's attracting us to that person? How that person manifests? Is it because they're charismatic? Because they're very fluent with their words? They're very articulate? Is it because they can tell you the context in very precise words, the problem and the resolution? What is it? We should know what it is that we're getting, how we're getting fed by the teacher. Because how we're getting fed usually sets up for the dependency towards that teacher. And some teachers hold us in their aura through their empowerment. There are some very, very powerful human beings on this planet, energetically. And we feel somewhat special to be even within the frame of their reference. And so that's alluring in itself, because many of us don't carry that sense of specialness to our self-assumptions. We don't think of ourselves as being special. So if we get within the inner circles of some of these teachers, we feel that we're living a very special spiritual life. But it's also important to ask what motivates this person to teach. What is it, you see? What is this person getting out of teaching? Sometimes it's self-embellishment. They like being seen. They like the egoic image of being a teacher. And you can feel this. What I want to take you to is not so much you're guessing at why they're up there, but you have a sensing of why they're up there that is often more true than the concepts that you're bringing to, or the reasoning that you're giving to why you're attending that particular sangha. And you can get a feeling, and this is in a sense a warning to all of you, and this is where I think that many of you, if not all of you, will at some time in your spiritual life slip on this issue, is that we'll give ourselves over to a sangha or teacher for the wrong reasons. Is that person up there for power or for love? And love doesn't look like this heart, doesn't necessarily look like this heartwarming, affectionate. It doesn't necessarily, it might look like wanting you to know, a desire to for you to know, you see, a desire for you to understand. I was always attracted to people who had a deep yearning for me to understand what they were saying, because I realized it was not an egoic function on their part. That was their manifestation of love. That was how they, that was, the teaching was so important to them and they wanted to share that. But you can feel it. And so I want you to get a sense of, when you're in front of teachers, get a sense of what it is that they're offering and why. And what is it that you're receiving by being there? Because these sanghas can, and I'm not just talking about Buddhist sanghas. In this tradition, they're relatively safe because we've done away with a lot of the formalities of bowing to the teacher and all of that sort of thing, which can easily get us caught in that particular dynamic. But there are many places that you will go that do have formal ways that the teacher is revered, and you can easily get caught in that system. And so one of the things that was very important to me was that I read once, it was Krishnamurti, and I deeply appreciated his teaching. And I got caught in a particular sangha that had a very powerful teacher. And he kept saying that I wasn't surrendering enough to him. And I read this Krishnamurti quote, which sometimes happens, these serendipitous quotes come to you at the right time. And he said, in this quote, he says, never give up your ability to make decisions for yourself. That's the one inward authority that none of us should ever compromise. And I saw that that's what was being asked of me in this particular scene. And the way the scene was framing it was that, you know, unless I gave up that authority issue, that somehow I wasn't sincere, that I was just going with my ignorance. It's a very persuasive argument to somebody who really does meaningfully want to give up their ego, but that's not the way to do it. You don't give up your ego by giving up your decision making. I hope we all realize that. And this sense of needing to surrender to someone, when I use the word, and I use it frequently, I use it like this. I say, surrender your separation. Don't surrender your authority. So I'm not asking any of us to surrender to someone, and that includes to God or to anything. But when you surrender the narrative between you and life, then you're surrendering over your separation. And that's a different kind of letting go. So these points are, they seem perhaps very subtle in their differences, but they're very meaningful when you're involved in a scene in which you're asked to do something which is cross-grained to the purpose of your spiritual journey. And even though you might sense it, you see, with everybody else in the room claiming the beauty of the relationship between them and the teacher, and their open-hearted relationship and the degree of devotion and all of the things that manifest within a skewed sangha, it's very easy just to forget these very basics and to give yourself over in an unskillful way. So I have a few inward questions that we can ask when we might get caught in a scene like that. The basic one is, does this feel right to me? And there, quite likely there will be something in your consciousness that says it's not, something's wrong here. But you will likely, if it's a very strong scene, you can just push that way back into the subconscious and enjoy yourself within the scene as it manifests. But don't forget that feeling that there's something amiss here is often key. So let that come out, let it be seen. And if you're not able to bring that up to the teacher, then you realize that there really is something wrong with this scene, because everything should be open for exploration. Is my will being taken away? That is my ability to assert my own authority, to make my own decisions. We should have that, we should know that in ourselves. Does it mesh with my insights? And some scenes, usually the scenes can become so powerful in themselves, so enclosed in themselves, that they become exclusive to others who are not willing to give over or surrender their will to that scene. Now, this is really key. There are certain Dharma principles that every scene should access. And one of them is that the Dharma is always inclusive, never exclusive. And so if a scene feels exclusive, allowing some people in and not others, or allowing no one to leave without berating them, then you know there's something wrong. Is this teaching based in kindness? Is there heart here? Is it inclusive, as I mentioned? Does it have integrity? See, these are, I mean, you would think we would just know that. But when you're side by side with a charismatic, powerful, energetically powerful teacher, all of that gets trashed. Integrity, inclusivity, loving, kindness, all of it gets trashed in order for the relationship to be sustained. That's not staying within yourself. That's losing yourself. And it needs to be shored up. These questions are questions of sincerity, not questions of disloyalty to the teacher. To be able to ask the teacher the most fundamental basic questions about him or her. Can you question the teacher? That's a good one, because most of those scenes you can't. Now, the other component that comes along as the years of maturation occur is that we have a Dharma understanding in here that gets pretty well set over the years. We know what the Dharma is, and we even begin to live it. So those Dharma principles that we have practiced for so long become integrated into our lives. And we have to be very careful that we're not compromising those principles in any way, shape, or form with any scene. That is, that we are willing to live our deepest knowing. Now, each of you have a knowing, a Dharma knowing. Willingness to live it, to live the knowing that we have, that staying within ourselves, You see, most of us, because the logic of that knowing may run counterintuitive to the cultural knowing, we release the cultural knowing, no, we release the Dharma knowing and try to live in accordance to the standards of the public. But that's not living the deepest integrity of our lives. And we have to at some place take a stand on what we know and live that knowing. I may be saying things that everyone is saying, oh, I know that, but are you living it? Are you actually doing it? All of us have the opportunity to call ourselves back to the basics of being in the body. I may not know what the body is, but I know I have one. And I may not know what existence is, but I know I exist. To call ourselves back right here to the body, to our existence, that's where the Dharma is. That's where it lays. It doesn't lay in some conceptual field of someone else's power. It doesn't lay in somebody else's context, according to somebody else's script. It lays right here, right now, with the practicalities of what I know and what I do not, and the willingness to admit the differences between that. I don't know what he's talking about. I may at some point, but I'm not going to just assume I know what he or she is saying. I'm going to I'll listen to it. Perhaps I'll be curious about it, and I'll let that curiosity find its own root system within my body and mind and see if it is true for myself. See, that all of a sudden we have landed. We have embodied the terrain of where the Dharma is. To start assuming some of this logic prior to our understanding or our realization of that logic is just childish, really. Now, every Dharma teacher will state principles that we either understand or don't. That's fine. Many things are said, I've said many times, for instance, forcible, ambitious effort really has very little place in Dharma growth. Which is true, but it may not be true for you. It's true, but it's relatively true. Because from a beginner's point of view, it may be that the beginner, and usually is true for the beginner, that they have to put forth a lot of effort to find their breath, even though they have a breath or a body, to know that a thought is even occurring, to have a location for themselves here and now. And that effort is worthy effort. It's worthwhile effort. And if that is where you are, then you listen to the fact that when I say effort is to be released, release yourself from ambitious effort, and you say, well, that may be true, but it's not true for me. I need my effort. I can see that it's helpful to try very hard to find my breath, to keep coming back, to return again and again. So that's what's I mean by staying within yourself, staying within the context of your own understanding of where each of our practice lies. And at another point, it will dawn on you as you continue to mature that the forcible effort, the tension of effort, is keeping something at bay. It's helping in certain ways, but it's a limitation in other ways. And at some point it does have to be released, but it has to be released at your timing, not the teacher's timing. A teacher can't stand up and speak to 100 people and say anything that's clearly applicable to each and every one of you. So it's up to you to decide whether it's relevant to you or not. That's staying within yourself. That's staying within your own understanding. That's keeping it open. You don't have to dismiss what the teacher says. He says, I just don't know that. Maybe at some point I will, but right now it makes no sense to me whatsoever. See? So staying within yourself is the principle on which the direction takes. Now, here's the other thing about knowing the direction. Remember I said how important that was early on, was to establish a direction for your practice. Because what we miss through all of this turmoil for years into our practice is to keep looking at what we're doing in terms of the direction we have established for our practice. Is what I'm doing creating more suffering for myself? Or is this releasing or alleviating the suffering? Is the effort I'm creating around the tension of finding my breath helpful or not? Is the ambition I have towards wanting to be somewhere that I'm not in my spiritual journey, and the tension that accrues from that ambition and from that wanting, is that more suffering or less suffering? And so whenever I do something in practical terms or follow someone else or listen to a teacher in the words that they're saying rather than to myself, I can be sure that if I'm not living my own truth, there will be tension associated with what I would like to be and where I would like to go according to the teacher's words, as opposed to where I really am and what I really need to be. And that tension has to be listened to. Oh, I see. All right. I'm trying to live ahead of myself. And it's very common for people to say, and I've had many, many students tell me how they think it's going too slow for them, and you just want to say to them, you know, well, you're creating a lot of suffering for yourself. Doesn't that have any relevance to you? Or is where you're going the alleviation of suffering? Because if it is, I would drop those thoughts if I were you. Or are you going towards more suffering, and in which case continue to think that way? But we don't use ourselves as the context within the direction we're taking. We think there's some place in which there won't be any suffering. No, it's a moment-to-moment decision as to whether we're going to suffer or not in that next moment. And that's not the context that we have for our spiritual journey. But it needs to be. The context needs to be brought home. So it was a much too ambitious talk, but then that's because I haven't been giving very many. There's a lot I wanted to say, but so I wanted to sort of give you a context of the talk in terms of just two or three different recipes that I like. So to assume anything without fully integrating will come back and haunt you. When you make an assumption, spiritual assumption, about the journey or about yourself on the journey, and it's outside of the experience that you're actually having in the journey and your realization of the journey, it will come back and haunt you. There will be friction. And you begin to learn how to listen to Dharma talks without throwing yourself at the mercy of where the words are going, and staying within the body and the integrated understanding that you have. We've got to learn that. Being truthful in all regards. Period. I'm not going to try to fool myself about where I am and what I would like to know and I don't know. I'm not going to fool myself about the nature of my belief and thoughts I need more attention to thoughts. Because when we're paying attention to the truth, when we are following the truth, then we're following the Dharma. When we aren't, when we're subtly pretending or fabricating to ourselves, then we're following the conceptual world. And those two will be at odds with each other. So, okay, so am I understanding what's going on here? Maybe I just need to go back and spend more time with my breath and know that I'm here. I mean, this thing's about being here. Okay, let me be here. Now, what is here? I don't even know what here is. I hear it, but I don't live it. What is here? Why can't I live here? You see, these are really, they're truthful questions. Aren't they? They're raw. They expose all of the pretensions. But the rawness of it, it gets to the, see, that's the level of truth that this thing has to, this is the core that it has to resonate with. And what do I know? Well, I know I have a body. I don't really know what the body is. I know what it is conceptually. But when I go experience it, I don't, like, it doesn't hold its boundaries. It doesn't feel like the same thing it does when I look at it or when I read about it. So what's that about? And I know I exist. Well, I can tell you I exist. I mean, that's one thing I'm absolutely sure of. There's existence. But what is the existence? Well, what is it that I'm claiming to exist? And is it really existing? I know there's existence. I mean, that can't be denied. But what's the claim to it? What am I putting as the manifestation that's existing? What is that? You see, these are questions. If we go in that direction, your path will be straight. It will be from suffering to the end of suffering. It will be honest and straightforward and truthful, integritous, kind, because very quickly you'll learn if it's not, you'll suffer more. Quiet, because you'll be asking questions inquisitively. And every time you ask a question and you don't know, rather than looking for a dependency to that knowing, you'll be quiet and try to understand for yourself. And so quietness will be an accompanying part of that. And it won't be based on belief. Why won't it be based on belief? Because belief requires grouping together with other people who believe together to keep everybody safe from the counter influences of the alternative to the belief I have. But as soon as I question that belief, I'm alone. I'm not in a group anymore. I'm independent. I'm not dependent. The moment I ask, what is this belief? And is it true? Now I stand separate from the group of people who are believing as I once was. And I don't like that. I want to be a part of the group. But instead of checking out my dependency, which is my suffering, I'm suffering, I'm feeling the need for to be dependent. Instead of checking out what dependency is in me, I'll just throw myself in, cover over all the questions and go back to being dependent. But the Dharma practitioner says, what is this dependency? Why is it that I need this group? Why is it that I feel so much more pleasure in a group than standing alone? The moment we ask that, we have independence from the group. Anytime you question a belief, you stand alone. Anytime you question anything, you stand alone. And this is a solitary journey, my friends. because everything has to be questioned. We meet, what brings us together as a Sangha is our independence of each other. And that is enlivening. So we come as a Sangha to gather around the aliveness of each other. Not because we are all consumed within the belief about the Buddha. That's what makes us a Sangha. And we find that the quieter we become, at first, it feels like we're alone in the quiet. But then something strange and wonderful occurs within the understanding of that quiet. Suddenly things come together in a completely different way than they came together when I believed the same thing with other people. A very different form of the collective. A very different understanding of interconnection. That's what it means to stay within yourself. Thank you. Could we sit for a minute or two? See, to even be interested in the Dharma, there has to be a quality of maturity that we all have, or we wouldn't be here. Not to say that we are pain-free by any measure of imagination. But there has to be a level of maturity when we're talking about standing and questioning beliefs. And not groupthink. When we listen to the words of the Buddha and say, well, that's interesting, I don't know what he's saying. I'll see if I can match it to my own experience. If not, I'll let it go. Maybe some other year I'll come back to it, but not now, I don't understand it. I'm not going to quote it, that's for sure. Somebody asked me, another teacher says, why don't you ever quote the Buddha? And I said, if I know it, why would I quote the Buddha? And if I don't know it, why would I quote the Buddha? That's the independence that's needed. Okay, so any questions or comments? I'd be happy to. So the question is not so much to approach a teacher for the surrendering your will, but for the affirmation of your own worth. right? Well, if the truth be known, you are good. I mean, that there's a truth to that. And most of us believe in the tainted side of ourselves, which is the conditioned side of ourselves. That's what we've learned. That's how we've learned to handle ourselves in times of when we're afraid, basically. But under that, as that conditioning is peeled away, as we are laid bare to just awareness, you'll see that there's a basic goodness. And the teacher, if he or she is reputable, should be able to point to that basic tenet, that underlining truth, that there is basic goodness in each of us, rather than to the cultural influence of how it is that we still lie and do distorted things. Those things are just what we've learned how to protect ourselves. But that doesn't in any way touch the basic goodness that's the underlining thing. Now, if you're attracted to somebody who gives that message, it means that there's something in you that acknowledges that truth, that somehow feels there that there's something true about what's being said. And that resonance is very important. If you're going to have a relationship with a teacher at all, that resonance, that they're saying something that resonates deeply with you, is very important. But not to then assume that whatever the teacher says is true just based upon that resonance. The resonance is the first step inward. The next step is to actually look and see whether that basic goodness is there in you or not. That comes after you've resonated with the fact that you think it's true, but you haven't realized that fact. It's like all of us know we're going to die, okay? I resonate with that fact. 70 years old. There will be a moment if you interface with the dying, and if you study and if you investigate it sufficiently, that you will realize that you are going to die. That is a traumatic moment. I mean, traumatic in the sense that it's like, takes your breath away, Jesus. Whoa, this is going to happen to me. It's happened to me a number of times, so it's not just, but it's always the same. It's like, wow, you know, because you can conceptually play this thing, and so you don't want to conceptually play it. You want to get in there and actually bear its truth to you, right? And don't you know you're basically good? I think most of us do. It doesn't mean that we don't get lost in, you know, but there's something good in us. Now, here's a mistake we make in the election time, if I can bring this up, because a couple of points I want to make about this. One is the unskillful way that we face one-way mirrors. Many of us get all of our information from sources that algorithms that know exactly the way we think and feed us that attitude back to ourselves. So we don't have access to true questions. We have access to the conforming way that we believe the world should be. This is not helpful, people. I would really encourage you to look at your relationship to these social networks. This is not helpful, not spiritually helpful, for you to read what you already believe. The other thing is the anger that came after the election. Instead of wanting to listen to the 50% of the population, minus 2 million votes, and see what's going on. I mean, we want to build a wall, don't we? Is that any different than what is being espoused by the opposite side? Where's the Dharma in this? The situation didn't come out the way we wanted. Circumstances don't usually work that way. They don't happen the way we want them to. That's what the Dharma bases itself on. That's suffering. Instead of acknowledging that and working with it intuitively by listening and integrating ourselves into the reality that's there, we're creating more of a schism between that which we want and that which is occurring. This isn't Dharma. And that was, I think, a beautiful lesson to see how deeply integrated we are in our Dharma. There it was. What did I say in the talk that gave rise to this question?
That we might have a fundamental belief about the Dharma that,
Okay.
Like a safety valve.
Okay, we're not going to be Pollyannish, okay?
No, I'm not.
Okay, there are moments when we suffer and there may be rare moments when we don't. We know that that's a possibility,
yes.
Right? We can see expanded times when we're extremely aware and times when we're closed down. And one, coincidentally, we don't suffer in, and the other one we do. Okay? So to know the direction our practice takes is fundamental to the journey. It's not being Pollyannish. It's not glossing over,
but
right?
I can only know about my...
Okay. Use your experience. Do you know of times when you don't suffer and what's going on within those times that you don't?
Is it naive to think that there's a communal experience possible?
As you relinquish the need to be separate, you will feel more and more that communal experience, and it'll become a living reality. There's also the resonance of hearing that and saying, this is true. Somehow I know that this world is much more connected than I've lived it to be. And you get a sense of that. Now, you may not know it as a realized truth, but the resonance is enough to give you to get you going in a wise direction, right? So that's skillful. What you want to do is to keep profoundly understanding that principle more and more. Right? So, when you're just believing something, like when I die, I go to heaven, I'm not sure I'd want to. Where you just, first of all, it doesn't sound that good once. That's the first thing. Second thing is, what's that based on? What's that based on? And do I have any knowledge of that in my, so I'm not going to, that's a belief that I can release because I don't know it's not true. I just have no reference for it at all. Anyway, it's on the hereafter, and I'm living the here, not the after, right? So I can't, so that's going to take care of itself. I'm just not going to, and I'm not even drawn towards it. What I'm drawn towards is the suffering that's occurring now. Now I'm planted, I'm landed, and I can, this gives me an issue I can work with, because I see when I do this, I suffer more. When I don't do that, I don't suffer. Okay, I'm on my way now, right? I know to go this way and not that way. Now I go this way, and then it gets more subtle the way I suffer. I say, well, that's still suffering, so let me go this way. So we keep turning left. Right? So I'm not asking you to believe anything that isn't within the... The one caveat is that we do start in faith. All of us, we don't have any experience. Oh, we have a resonance, you know, that, I mean, you wouldn't come to second class unless there was something resonating from the first class. So that drives us for a while. But there's a downside to faith. The downside to faith is that I start leaning on ways to prove my faith through belief. Okay, that's not so helpful. And the Dharma quickly tries to pull that rug out from under you by giving you some realization of its context, that things are changing in permanence, for instance, right away. You know, from the day you land on your breath to the day you see the thoughts passing through your mind and the body is continually in motion, all of that gives you an immediate context for something to land on. It's realized, right? So then you just keep moving it in the direction of realization like that. That's what the point. But it doesn't give you, I mean, if I, you know, you read something in the literature about the cosmos and the 11 layers of this or that, or the, you know, it's like, this has nothing to do with me. Or rebirth. What do I know about that? Well, maybe you've had an actual living experience of that. Some people have. I haven't. So I don't even talk about it. Why? Because it's not relevant to me. Right? So it doesn't take away a thing. Right? So that you see how I'm steering this thing? I'm steering to what's a sense of resonance, practicality, realization, staying within myself, throwing away issues that have no meaning to me, that seem to be just conceptual. You know, I don't want to bother myself with all those philosophical points. I don't want to. All the devas and all, I don't want to know about all that stuff. Why? I'm here. This is where I start. This is where I land. This is what I can focus on and question. This is what I can gain a realization from. Right here. Okay. That's called staying within yourself. Here opens. Here doesn't stay narrow and, you know, like, I kind of stay here. You can't stay anywhere but here. At some point you realize that. There's nowhere else to go. You can't go anywhere else. Anywhere else also has the context of here, and we're just missing that context. That's all that's happening. Nothing can happen outside of this context. You see how big it gets? That's what happens when you realize and start from here. It doesn't stay small. It gets very big. Okay, enough for tonight.